Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Pull Up Podcast, brought to you by HoopsCritic.com.
And welcome, everybody, to another episode of the Pull Up Podcast, brought to you by HoopsCritic.com. We have none other than Tommy D, formerly of the Knicks blog, but now is heading up Charged FM, a great source over there. Make sure you download the app. Follow him on Twitter at Tommy, the letter C, D, D-E-E. And without further ado, how are we doing today, Tommy?
I'm doing really well, Jacob. Thanks for having me on, man. How you doing?
We're doing great. Finally got a basketball game. These 2 days in between is killing us here. However, at the same time, we don't want it to go too fast now. We want to take it all in, especially from a series that seemed like it was going to be a quick four-game series, but now Cleveland's made it interesting. What are your first takes from the first two games in the series?
Besides the absolute joy and pleasure of loving basketball and being dismissive to a point, because you feel like you watch so much basketball and you just kind of recognize trends, and obviously after game one with Kyrie Irving going out, and the overtime loss, which you would have thought would have been an excruciatingly painful thing for LeBron James, but here's the beauty of the amazing all-time athlete playing at his absolute best, which LeBron James is, able to bounce back in game two. And what I really thought was the biggest thing and the biggest sign and message from game two, not only is LeBron going back to Cleveland, his home team, his home state of Ohio, you know, with that win and home court advantage, just wrestling it away from Steph Curry and the Golden State Warriors. He showed them at the end of the game that he still had plenty in the tank and that this team was going to be absolutely in this going forward for the next bunch of games. So tonight is going to be an interesting game with full of emotion, and that was really showed by LeBron at the end of game two. I thought it was awesome.
Right. Just when you think you've seen it all from LeBron, or he's plateaued, or he's peaked, or whatever term you want to throw out there to kind of summarize his game as a career, he just keeps getting better, and nothing amazes me anymore, LeBron, I should say. Like, I feel like I've seen it all, but yet I feel like tonight and in the next game we're going to see something even better with this guy. But let's jump across the table for a second here for a guy who won the MVP award this year, but had, I've been calling it, one of the worst final games I've ever seen. And people, you know, obviously throw out stats, and someone was challenging me on Twitter about LeBron's 2011 games 3, 4, or 5 against the Dallas Mavericks being worse, but they actually weren't statistically. But Steph Curry had one of the worst games I've ever seen. Not only just his shots weren't falling, he didn't play much defense, and his passing was just very poor and lazy. What do you expect out of Steph Curry in Game 3 tonight? Do you think he goes back to, you know, the MVP self, or are you afraid there might be a trend coming here?
I really think he got his bell rung when he fell against Houston. I think there's something there that kind of knocked him off of you know, a pedestal there in my mind, because you know he's not a physical player, and to me, you know, when you're talking about the finals, you're talking about big games, I always think the advantage should be closer to the basket. If you have a great post player, if you have a guy who can do both, but specifically post, you see a lot of dump downs and ISOs, and that you've seen a ton in the first two games. Steph Curry is not that type of player. He's a pick and roll guy who needs space, and the easiest thing to do for a defense in the half court game, in my opinion, is take space away. Tristan Thompson and Mozgov have played a ton together, as has LeBron. And that's really made Curry, you know, shoot those longer shots. And let's face it, the basket shrinks. I think when you factor in, you know, trying to get him, or at least test his physical strength as a guard, you know, and then creating situations where he's got to take shots from the perimeter further on, it's going to be hard to establish a rhythm. If Cleveland can continue to pressure Curry and put him in a situation where physically he's going to have to attack the basket. That's at his disadvantage, and I think that's why he's been struggling, going back to the series in Houston.
Now, are you concerned, because this is something that's kind of been bugging me with the Golden State Warriors, I feel like they are, you know, they're lacking an offensive initiative, meaning they're just taking, you know, quick threes early in shot clocks, late in games. They're not really running any plays. I don't see many screens to get Curry open. Like, I just feel like they're not working to get each other open. They're kind of just, you know, expecting these shots to fall because they are such a good shooting team, and it's almost just like, you know, shooters are going to just keep shooting until they get their touchback. But at the same time, when the buckets aren't falling like they haven't been in these two games, they really struggle to get some buckets. Sometimes you need an easy bucket, and sometimes you just got to run a couple screens and run a play here to, you know, get everybody in rhythm.
That's the word that I was about to just use, and you hit the nail on the head, and I'll piggyback on that word. It's rhythm. And if you're a shooter and you struggle with your rhythm, and you saw this early on in game two, Klay Thompson came out and had a great rhythm, which was a great sign, then he gets into foul trouble and essentially disappears for the rest of the game. Shooting is all about rhythms. The Warriors play, and you read it all across, you know, the internet and whatever print publications still exist. You know, you talk about great basketball and beautiful basketball, and everybody loves Golden State because they're just an easy team to root for. That's great. But guess what? They are an easy team to root for, and it's great basketball when they're in rhythm. Cleveland knows a thing or two about getting in and defensively making sure that rhythm is not something that you're going to have all game long. I see them coming out, talking about Golden State in game three, and trying to establish that. I don't know. I'll tell you the guy who they need to put in and add to that rhythm, because he's a good catch-and-shoot guy from mid-range, David Lee. He saved them in Memphis. He was really, really good, 12 to 15 feet for first half minutes in that big game. I guess it was game four, where they needed to tie up the series against Memphis, if my memory serves me properly. But put David Lee in the game, get him some spot-up mid-range touches, and you'll see that space kind of work itself out, and they'll get that rhythm back.
Now, we saw a tweet yesterday. I don't know if you caught it, but I haven't seen many people talk about it, but Klay Thompson had his knee wrapped up and had a noticeable limp getting off the team bus for shoot around and what have you. Is that any concern for you, especially with the struggles of Curry, as you point out, after he, you know, took that hard fall that looked scarier than it actually was, you know, thankfully. But is that any worry to you for the Golden State Warriors that Klay Thompson might be banged up as well, and if he's having knee problems, that might hinder his mobility?
I don't think so, because I think everybody's banged up. If he can't play, I'd be more concerned, but I think Golden State would figure it out. They don't have a lot of depth. I think that's fair, so you have to be really careful, but I think Klay is young enough and tough enough that he's going to play through whatever. Everybody's got injuries, I think, at this stage, unless, you know, it's a Kyrie type situation where he needs surgery, you're going to be in there. My concern with them is Bogut. My concern with them is matching up with what Cleveland does. Cleveland is now putting Mozgov at the forefront. They are putting Tristan Thompson at the four, and in extended minutes, they're playing LeBron. Pick your position, one, two, or three, and also at post on offense. So they're running the offense through him, whether it be the pinch post or either block. So Golden State's got a problem there. They need to match up with that. I really respect – people have given David Blatt a lot of heat over the year, you know, just in how he's managed this team. But he's done an incredible job, I believe, in following LeBron's lead, saying we're going to feature you in the post, run stuff through you, but also we're going to go big. He did take heat in game one. You know, it was really good coaching, you know, Steve Kerr going small and running them out of the gym when they had that opportunity in overtime. Blatt came right back with going big, and it really helped them in game two, solidifying that one and taking back home court.
Yeah, that's a concern for the Golden State. I just felt like at stretches, especially in game two where they were playing behind most of the time, especially in the second half, I just felt like they really struggled to get an easy two within the paint. Obviously, the famous Maurice Spaghetti's missed dunk, which I guess he's now missed three out of four dunks in the postseason, so that's not really a high percentage.
maybe he should stop trying there, right?
Right. I mean, that run was painful to watch. I really thought he was just going to fall down when he was running up the court there. And maybe that furthers your point. Maybe you throw David Lee out there for those minutes, who you know, is probably a little more healthy than Maurice Spieth this time of year right now, especially when he's riding the pine. But let's hop over to Cleveland here for a minute, because they really haven't had a Robin to LeBron James's incredible Batman. He's more like Superman right now. Who are you expecting to kind of shine in Game 3 to, you know, give Cleveland a chance to take a series lead here?
That's a great question. You know, I've seen enough of J.R. Smith, who probably played one of the dumbest and worst games of any player in recent memory in Game 2, and he was dreadful. Anytime your coach throws his arms up on multiple occasions, and LeBron does as well, and it kind of in the what are you doing way, you know, that you know that a player did something completely ridiculous, and JR can do that. He also can come out and bang down, you know, 5-6 threes, and you know, when you talk about rhythm, I don't think there's another or a better rhythm player when his jump shot is on than JR. He just takes ridiculously bad shots. I hope that they don't rely on that. You know, Tristan Thompson's a guy who's going to have to score for them and get them some easy baskets. And to me, it goes, you know, to Mozgov, who's really played well. He's expanded his game. He's good on both short corners and short posts. And, you know, he's shown the ability to knock down an elbow jumper and a jump up here and there and put back stuff on the offensive glass. So from the guard perspective, LeBron's your guy, and then inside – it's most certainly Mozgov, and he's raised his level of game, and I don't see him going backwards. He's completely outplayed Andrew Bogut and has put Cleveland in a good situation. To me, that's the matchup. If Bogut comes out, or if it's David Lee or Spieth, as you mentioned, you know, if one of those guys outplays Mozgov, Golden State will win because they'll open up the floor more. But to me right now, Mozgov's been the Cavs' second-best player without question.
Absolutely. I mean, he's just been the most consistent outside of LeBron James on that roster. One guy who has been consistent, but not with his minutes. He's kind of a polarizing figure throughout these playoffs. The team is 5-0 when he plays over 30 minutes. And Charles Barkley actually had a little comment about this and just said, you know, relax on Matthew Dellavedova. He didn't shut down Steph Curry. You know, Curry just had an off game, but Curry would eat him up, which I agree with that point. However, you have to look at the stats of Matthew Dellavedova guarding these point guards throughout the postseason, and everyone struggled when he's on them. You know, whether it's just being a pest or whether it's really good defense, he's definitely getting under the opponent's skins. Kind of just tell me, you know, what you like and what you don't like about Matthew Dellavedova's game.
First and foremost, I love his development. I love how he's come in, you know, somewhat out of nowhere, played an entire season, and now is playing his best basketball when it matters most. That those are the qualities in a player, you know, that you really look for. You know, taking advantage of opportunities, being a great teammate, making the extra play, getting on the ground for loose ball, saving possession. You know, that's the stuff that shows there's still plenty in the tank. And I think people look at him and they say, well, this guy's not a starter. You know, this guy, they have Kyrie, you know. He's not a 30-minute-per-game guy, but the stat that you read before about their record when he plays 30 minutes tells you the exact opposite. He's got a ton of talent, and he's taking advantage of his opportunity right now. You know, to me, we'll see how good he is if he can consistently do this. But he's been a big-time storyline in this series, and I expect it to continue. Confidence is growing, and then when a young player gets confidence in a small sample size, here's the opportunity for that player to really make a big-time name for himself and then cash in afterward, so there's extra motivation there. I've been super impressed with Dellavedova, and I expect it to continue.
You know, the one thing that kind of makes this series curious to me is the overreaction. And it's just Twitter. I know it comes with it. But even some, you know, national media writers are – I think people are getting too far and, you know, this team needs to make this drastic change or that team needs to make this drastic change. To me, I think both game plans are working for their teams. These games are coming down to the wire. And for me, it's mostly fourth quarter execution, which is making a break in the W's for these two teams. So I don't think there's much to do in terms of really, you know, overhauling the game plan or what have you. However, what would you like to see done differently or better from each of these two teams?
To me, and I put this on Steve Kerr, you know, whose resume is having obviously won and played for the great Phil Jackson and also Greg Popovich as well. You know, that's his pedigree. Those are his mentors and folks who taught him the game. Both of those coaches, and I'm going to say specifically with Phil because everybody knows what Zen is, right, and what his whole philosophy was. Zen essentially is embracing the moment and understanding where you are in that time in the moment. And what the Bulls were the best at was that when times were the toughest in the fourth quarter of close games and they needed to value possessions, they did. They were better than everybody. They were just more at ease. They were more at peace. Obviously, it helped that they had Michael Jordan. But the surrounding guys, Steve Kerr, also, you know, was somebody who, you know, had the opportunity to make shots around him, around Jordan. And that's where, for me, you know, Steve Kerr should know better than to have possessions wasted, which they have in the first two series. So I put a big level of blame on Steve Kerr, you know, who should have his team much more focused and valuing possessions down the stretch. I think Cavs just ran out of gas in game one and allowed for Golden State to kind of capture that game at the end. But I think Steve Kerr needs to do a much better job coaching possessions down the stretch in the fourth quarter. That's where championships are won. So if everybody wants to sit here and tell everybody else, the media wants to tell everybody how great Steve Kerr has been, they need to also be very, at least in my mind, they need to be fair that he's done a poor job managing possessions down the stretch.
Right, I absolutely agree. And going back to Blatt here, I think Blatt is getting a lot of the Eric Spoelstra treatment here, and I don't know if he actually got to call Eric and say, how'd you deal with all this scrutiny? Basically, everyone says LeBron runs the team, but anyways, I agree with you. I think both these coaches have done a great job to get to this point, but each of them have had a little hiccups here and there, and that's just a growing process. We're dealing with two rookie head coaches here. Last question on these finals before we jump into what you really want to get into, which is exciting in the New York area, some NBA draft talk, but who do you think has the advantage going into Game 3 right now?
Oh, I think Cleveland. I think, again, when I look at LeBron at the end of that game and the energy that he showed, kind of telling Steph Curry and the Warriors, you know, that he's got plenty in the tank. You know, they're going to go to Cleveland and the fan base is going to be obviously very, very excited. The energy there is going to be ridiculous. So I think anytime a team takes home court advantage, they have the advantage in Game 3. So I do expect Cleveland to come out. It's going to be a great game. Again, what you've seen already tendency-wise in the first two games is that, you know, there's a little run here, a little run there. You know, the game's relatively close, and then it comes down to execution. And I hate using narrative, and I hate using cliches. Trust me, it's not one of my favorite things to do. But this is going to come down to, you know, a loose ball here, a bad foul call here. It's going to be a last, you know, probably one or two possession game, the last 5 minutes of the game, and it just comes down to who's going to value the possessions more and make more shots.
Absolutely. Now let's jump over to the NBA draft talk here, because the game's going to be exciting, and I'm with you. It's almost a coin flip for these games. I predicted Warriors in five, and I could still be right, or I could be very wrong. I think Game 3 is the pivotal game for this series, which tends to be the case when it's 1-1. But we have a very exciting NBA draft class, and before we get into the who, what, where, when, and why of this draft class, I just want to pick your brain on how do you kind of rank this class compared to years past? Is it as good as 2003, which I don't think anything will be, but is it like that, or is this going to be a dud of a draft? Like, how do you assess this year's draft selection?
Gotcha. And we can go back to 84, which is a great draft, and 90, which was a tremendous draft, 92. To me, it's good. It's really good. It's as good as I've seen probably since 03. This is probably my biggest hobby. I obsess over the draft, and it's something that I just live and breathe. Really, really strong talent, 1 through 7. The way that I would grade it, if we were just going off of 100 being, you know, the number one pick or whatever, I think everybody 1 through 7, maybe 8, is anywhere between you know, 98 and 94, 95. So like it's top heavy for sure, but you're talking about really, really solid prospects who all have a lot of talent in a lot of different categories within themselves. A lot of times you'll see great explosiveness, you know, can't shoot, you know, one-dimensional guys on defense who can't play offense. You know, this is without question across the board the most talented group 1 through 7 I think I've seen probably since 2004, which was a really strong one at that level, and most definitely 2003.
And to further your point here, Tommy, you know, the top five of every draft are usually, you know, some solid studs. Obviously, a couple busts pop in those top-tier picks every once in a while. But for me, it's just the middle of the draft in the first round, and towards the end, you can get some real value here. And another thing that stands out to me in this draft, and this is where it's going to get fun trying to do a mock draft. I mean, you go to any mock draft, and everyone has different picks all around the board because, you know, you look at the top eight players and you got centers, you got guards, you got wingmen. So, you know, it's really coming down to need basis for teams and where they're selecting. And I think that's going to determine, I mean, obviously I think 1 and 2 are pretty set in stone, you know, flip a coin either way, but, you know, 3 through 8 is really going to be determined by, you know, teams that might not need a point guard, but the best point guard's there. Do they take them and look to move? So let's start with your beloved Knicks here, because they have the 4th pick, kind of just waiting and seeing what happens in the top 3. You know, Tommy D, you are the general manager of the New York Knicks. The 4th pick comes around. Are you picking more based on need or more based on best available?
To me, at 4, you have to really think about what you can do. It's all about options, and then you choose your best option. So, or what your best option would be. If I'm Phil Jackson, I'm listening to every single phone call. I'm listening to see and hear, you know, what the league and what each, you know, general manager and owner wants to do, and gathering that information and saying, okay, at 4, I know I'm going to get a really good player. I'm going to decide who I think the best player for our situation is at that moment, and I'm going to go down that path if a better deal doesn't come along. I look at Sacramento, they can move up. I looked at Minnesota, they may move down. They may not want a big. They may be satisfied with what they have. And look for someone who's going to maybe be the engine that gets LaVine and Wiggins out in transition. You know, if I'm the Knicks, I play the weight game, and then I look to see if any of the consensus top 3, talking about Towns, Okafor, and Russell, if they fall out of 3 and are sitting there at 4, I go that route. And I have deals. I'm talking to Denver. I'm talking to Sacramento. I'm listening to what Orlando wants to do, and maybe Boston. You know, an opportunity to move in, and I can, you know, get some of their 1 million draft picks that they've acquired over the last couple of years. I'm listening to everything, and on draft night, I'm waiting. And when we're on the clock, we're going to figure out exactly what direction we're going to go in.
So obviously, everyone talks enough about the two big guys. There's plenty of coverage out there. We're not going to break any ground talking about those two guys. But I want to talk to you about a couple of these foreigners here, especially the guy from Croatia who has a highlight reel and the famous word everyone loves to throw around there, swag. And that's Mario Hezonja. I'm probably pronouncing that last name wrong. But from what I've seen, he looks like a, you know, I like his size, I like his athleticism, and to me, something that I always point out, and I don't know how much this weighs on you, I like guys who did the Brandon Jennings route, and I know Mario probably didn't have a choice to come to an American college, but I like the guys who play professional basketball for a longer period before coming into the NBA, and I love that Brandon Jennings did that because I think it might have helped them, you know, ready for a, you know, longer season and stronger physical guys. So I want to ask you, how much weight do you put into, you know, a player who plays in the NCAA or plays overseas?
Well, in his own just case, what you love most about him is that, at least for me, you know, I haven't seen many prospects that can guard 4 positions and play 3. You know, he can't play the 1, but he can guard the 1 in pick and roll if he needed to switch. I think at his size, at 6'8", you know, in the ballpark about 220, 225, he can play some small four because he's in stretch four because he's an incredible shooter. He's easily the best shooter in the draft, and maybe one of the best shooting prospects since Klay Thompson, who in 2011 I had him number one overall because he was just an incredible offensive player who I felt could also defend and be a great two-way guy. I see the same thing with Mario. I value guys who do understand the professional game, but let's be fair. Duke is doing that. Kentucky is doing that. You know, if you go to the right programs and you play deep into March, you're basically playing a pro schedule anyway. You're playing in big arenas. You know, it's not that big of a difference. So I value all of Duke's guys. I really value Kentucky's guys very highly, you know, because it is that somewhat of a professional feel to it and what they do. Not to say that those are the only two schools, but certainly two of the top in the country without question. So I like both. I think travel is important when you're talking about you know, being ready and understanding what the NBA game means and is. But the European guys, Porzingis is another guy, needs to get a little bit stronger. It's going to take him a few years to kind of fill out. And that's, if you're talking about value, I'm concerned with guys who come in who are underweight and undersized because that's out of your control. You know, Sean, remember when Sean Bradley got drafted super high and he weighed about 110 pounds and he was 7'7", and Philadelphia wanted to tell you that, hey, we're going to bring Jeff Rulin in and he's gonna put 50 pounds on him, you know, every year. Just you can't control
right.
that. And
right.
And that to me is if you're talking about value, I'm most concerned about someone's strength when they come into the league.
You know, that's a great point, because not only you know, adding weight to a big guy, that can also cause foot injuries as well, because they might not be, you know, they might gain the weight too fast and the body's not ready for it. You know, obviously there's, you know, advances in medical sciences that can prevent that these days, but it's still a caution to worry about. So let me ask you about these two point guards here at the top, because we all know the point guard position in the NBA is probably the strongest. I don't think anyone's going to dispute that. It's just that every team has a point guard, basically, and you know, poor Rajon Rondo is going to have to find someone that needs a point guard, because nobody really does. But between D'Angelo Russell and Emmanuel Mudiay, how do you see these guys jumping into that, you know, core of NBA point guards? Like, where do you see them fitting in?
Gosh, I really like them both. My concern with Mudiay is that, you know, he doesn't shoot it as well as Russell, and he doesn't shoot it as well as a lot of point guard prospects. People want to say, oh, neither Derrick Rose and neither did John Wall. Those two were, without question, the number one pick overall in the draft. There was never a debate that Rose or Wall weren't going one, and obviously there's a big debate whether Mudiay can go one. I think he can. I'm not sensing or hearing any, you know, real strong, solid buzz out of the Lakers workout. Obviously, he's got the workout right to schedule with Knicks. So I'm interested to hear kind of what everybody's take is from a guy or on a guy who, you know, has been, let's face it, he's been a mystery over the last 12 months. We know what he was out of high school, decided to, you know, take his talents overseas, could have went to SMU. Larry Brown says, you know, thinks the world of the kid, which, you know, he sort of has to because he committed to him. Rick Pitino does too, so there's a lot of validity to those two guys. And for me, when you talk about playmakers and just guys who at the guard position who just have amazing feel, you know, that's Russell. You know, he played in a very strong, solid conference. You know, I have questions about his durability and his legs and, you know, kind of his strength. I think Mudiay, without question, ranks way above Russell in that sense. You know, but Russell has more length, and, you know, he has great feel for the game, which Mudiay does too. It's going to be interesting to see how, you know, the whole thing ranks itself out. I think Minnesota would love to have either at one. I just don't know if Minnesota can take a point guard at one when you consider kind of what they've gone through at the point guard position a couple of years back in 2009, drafting three, trading Lawson. Johnny Flynn obviously bombed, and Rubio has been somewhat of a bust to this point. I don't think you can take a guard in this draft, and maybe Minnesota got a little unlucky there, you know, getting that first overall pick.
Right, yeah. I mean, and I like what your point you brought up before is that they probably should trade out and get the value there, and you know, because they don't really need a big guy. I mean, everyone could use a big guy, but they might not need it. But hey, Tommy, this is the end of our show, but I will tell you what, we'll definitely get you back on as we get closer to the draft, as the season's over, and maybe we can start analyzing these picks and actually what happens as the trade talks and the draft discussions heat up.
Jacob, always a pleasure talking to you, my friend. Enjoy the game tonight, and all the listeners out there. It's going to be great basketball, and right on top of it, it'll be a real excited NBA draft following. So thanks for having me on, man. Appreciate it.
Anytime, Tommy. Everybody follow Tommy D. is at Tommy CD. That's D-E-E. Make sure you download the Charged FM app, and everybody take care.